Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today I'm joined again by the delightful Amy Elizabeth Fox. Amy is the co-founder of Mobius Executive Leadership, a leadership development firm at the cutting edge of transformational leadership work. Amy is leading their potent trainings around the world. And today we are going to dive into this topic of transformational leadership. We'll talk about love as a transformational tool and how we can open to a wider field of love. We'll talk about the stages of development that practitioners go through. I think Mobius have done some incredible work discerning some of the capabilities and skills that transformational practitioners need in order to do highly potent work. And we'll talk about the restorative process that individuals go through and the key shift for organizations of the future. So here we go. Here's the podcast with Amy. Before we get into today's podcast, I've got an invitation for you. We're about to kick off the sixth edition of our most popular program, The Neuroscience of Change. This training is based on what revolutionary research in neuroscience has revealed about transformational coaching, essentially showing us what works, what doesn't, and why. In the program, you'll learn what happens in the brain and body when different coaching techniques are used, how to guide your clients into positive learning states that allow genuine change to occur, and why some tried and true coaching methods actually inhibit change and what we can do instead. We created this course because I learned things from the lead teacher, Amanda Blake, that truly revolutionized the way I coach. And every year, she and all the teachers bring in new, cutting-edge science that continues to illuminate the process of transformation. Amanda will be joined by the rest of our world-class faculty of coaches and neuroscientists for this program, including Dan Siegel, Alan Fogel, Claire Dale, David Trelevin, and Richard Boyatzis. It's going to be an amazing, transformative journey, so I hope you'll come and join us. You can head to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. The first class is February 25th, 2025 with Amanda Blake. And if you sign up by February the 7th, you can get the early bird discount. So just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. So Amy, it's a delight to be with you once again, and I'm just really appreciating your radiant smile right now. Where are you? What are you up to at the moment?
Oh, well, first of all, let me say how wonderful it is to be again with you, Joel. Thank you for having me. And tonight I'm in Lisbon teaching a very deep dive program for 21 senior leaders, a transformational leadership program. And we're on day four. So my heart is, as you said, very radiantly open and touched by the depth of the work and the courage of the participants to really do profound healing work together.
So it's really cooking by now.
It's really cooking by now. Yeah. I mean, in general, I find that it takes, you know, sort of a day of arriving and de-shielding. But by the time we're at day two, people are really so hungry and longing for a place to put down their burdens and be less lonely and be re-inspired to life. It doesn't take all that long to get people to takes a certain cradling and a sense of safety and a very sophisticated team to hold the process, but the melting is pretty automatic. Yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful. So we might touch into some of the kind of ways you're holding space for these participants in our conversation today.
Wonderful.
I wanted to ask you, about love to begin with, because I know that's something I've seen you speak about, and it feels like, love has always been very pertinent for us as human beings, but perhaps even more in these times. So my question really is like how you hold love as a something that is part, an important part of the transformational process, and what it can allow for. Yeah.
It's a profound question. Maybe I'll come at it from a few angles and then let's dance together with it, Joel. I mean, one thing to say, as my teacher Thomas Hubel reminds us over and over, everyone we meet is the lineage holder of generations of unhealed trauma. everyone is walking with very deep hurts, if not in their own life story, although most often in their own life story, then in the life story of their parents and their grandparents, which showed up in their childhoods, either as impingements of challenge and violence and aggression, or as absences of holding and attunement and attention and celebration for the beauty of each child. So because we're walking around with hurt hearts, I don't believe there's any way to help people come back home to themselves other than creating a field of mature, unconditional love in which the parts of them that were never held, never seen, never safe, never invoked to their full expression, their full beauty, can really receive the balm of attuned witness and generous celebration and mutual arising. So that's a thing that we as practitioners can cultivate in our own hearts, the ability to really look, to gaze at someone's stunning, glistening uniqueness, and to reach for the parts of them that are more scared, more hurt, more lonely, more shameful, and invite them into contact. And in that process, which is deeply a loving process, it's a tender process. And at its best, it's a energetic and vibratory transmission of the wider field of love in which life is unfolding all the time. So the practitioner is part of that, but the participants themselves, when you're doing leadership work in a community setting, as I do, the participants themselves become a secondary reinforcing field of love for one another as they witness the leaps each of them are taking to look back on their life story and their life's challenges and reintegrate or really start to metabolize what is otherwise frozen memory, frozen sensation, buried unconscious emotion, stuck places in people's hearts. And my experience is that everywhere in society, what we're seeing are signs of unhealed trauma and stuck, closed, sealed off life that's just repeating loops of violent patterns. And so both at the micro level of me as a facilitator and one individual executive, at the level of a team who's living inside an organizational culture that is not functioning, and society writ large, which is in very stuck patterns, I don't know another answer than love. And I guess I would say one more thing, which is as a practitioner, if you tell yourself that that love is your personal love and your personal care for that person, that's a recipe for burnout. So the waterfall of that love has to come from your own interior connection to the wider field of love. One might call that the divine, one might call that nature, one might call that spirit, one might call that beauty. It doesn't really matter. But you have to tap into something enormous, vast, and eternal in order to really be a constant generator and provider of that love reliably. And that's, I think, the most important thing for practitioners to learn is how do I make that kind of cosmic connection inside myself? Yeah.
So much I want to ask you about in what you just shared. I'd like to ask you about how we can make that connection to that wider field of love. And inside of that, I have a question about the difference between, you know, like I've noticed in my experience, there can be this experience of presence, maybe awareness or presence, which often has a kind of benevolent or, you know, non-judgmental quality to it. But that can be quite distinct from this sense of love that you're talking about. And that maybe they often co-arise, but I wonder if that you see a difference there, and in a sense, what the experience of love and this connecting to this wider field of love is like for you.
Oh, that's a beautiful question. Let me take them one at a time. You asked me, how can you tap into it? And is spaciousness, stillness, presence the same as the field of love? And how do I experience that field of love? So those are three questions. The first one is easy. I think there are many doorways or portals into experiencing the nectar of kind of golden light that is around us. One of them is devotional poetry. I'm reading the poetry of Hafiz or Rumi or the Gnostics or Teresa of Avila, anyone who's been infused and permeated by a felt sense of the divine, speaks of and carries the frequency of, transmits this quality. So when you engage those texts, which are sacred texts, you're not just having an intellectual experience, you're receiving and imbibing of their state of communion. So that's one. More personally, I've been singing Hindu chanting, where you repeat mantras that are the names, various names of for the divine, for 40 years. And the daily singing of that devotional prayer, Krishnadas, one of my teachers, likes to say, gradually and inevitably opens the cave of your heart. I love the notion, gradually and inevitably. So that's another doorway. And you can do that in any text, in any language, in any prayer. Prayer itself is, of course, allowing yourself to sort of bow down and invoke or make requests of something higher, will bring that kind of luminosity or numinous quality into your field. Any artistic expression can do it. Dance can do it. Music, of course, does it. Beautiful paintings do it. Anytime in nature where you're in the extraordinary interdependent world of ecology, seeing the myriad expressions of extraordinary beauty that are fish and birds and plants and flowers and mountains and streams. And I mean, that's just enough to have a sense of, oh, I'm part of something much bigger. I think that the focus that we've had on as coaches and in the organizational industry, sort of the obsession with meditation and mindfulness, on the one hand, is phenomenal because it was like a breakthrough of spirituality starting to find its way in legitimately into the business world in a daily practice that people could do, that people could find accessible to integrate into their workday. They didn't feel embarrassed to do with their colleagues, and has immediate benefits, not just for psychological well-being and mental well-being, but for spiritual availability. And it bears the signature of how anti-eros we are as a society, because it's taught in its real austerity. It's not taught as an invitation to open yourself as a temple for this luminous experience of how imminent God is, of how present and available that quality of love is, as a felt sense, as a permeated experience of communion. So I do think in the end, presence is the same as the field of love, as the miracle field, but you have to nourish the ability to access that dimension of the stillness or of the spaciousness. Maybe that's how I would say it. And how it is for me, it's kind of ecstatic. It's a source of great joy. It's a source of real stillness inside me. It's a permeable membrane that allows life to touch me in constant ways, in both ways that are, you know, kind of wrenching and also ways that are so poignant and exquisite. And mostly what I feel is that as a practitioner, you can cultivate the ability to walk through life in a state of love. And when that happens, it comes back to you to a hundredfold, just a hundredfold. You know, I feel loved by people that are supporting me in so many different ways. My teachers, of course, and my extraordinary group of coaches and facilitators that work with me in Mobius. But honestly, the driver that takes me every time I come to Lisbon from the airport to the hotel, and you know, we've become friends and I know his family. And like, I think some of the things we think of as sort of transactional exchanges have so much more potential to be meaningful relationships. If you can open your heart just one notch more or two notches more and give constantly a sense of open invitation to connect in that depth, people will feel your invitation. They will respond pretty reliably. Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I think I also see how mindfulness can kind of reinforce a kind of materialistic or worldview in some ways. Like whereas I hear you talking about love in this way, but you know, you said like golden light and nectar. Those are very evocative words. And whilst I think presence and love ultimately are the same thing, maybe there's these different types of qualities that can shine forth. And so, you know, I just think of the experience I had recently where I did a meditation, and it was really about opening awareness. And, you know, it led to like a kind of blooming, vivid awarenessing feeling. And what struck me was that I went downstairs and then I watched a program that deeply moved me. It was just so human, and I was in tears. And I went out, and there was music with it as well. The music was perfect. And I went outside, and I was like, this is what I want, you know? So, and I was so in touch with my heart. There was this palpable sense of love and intimacy. It came with a kind of connection that was different from just the open awareness experience. And there was another thing I was going to say, but that was the there was a kind of contact and a re-enchantment of the world, which felt exquisite. So,
yeah, I mean, I think two things. One, we're talking about different facets of the unitive state. And one facet is, you know, Buddhists might call emptiness, we might call spaciousness, we might call infinite stillness and presence. And a different facet is this in, you know, sort of download of light into your field, and which is a bit more luscious as you're describing it. And in that luscious state, everything gets a little more luscious. Like you eat a meal and the food is suddenly tastes incredible. Like even the simplest ingredient has such amazing, you know, dimensionality to it. And the sky suddenly looks 10 times more vivid, and the rain feels so much more sensual. You know, the world is enchanted, to use your word, Joel, and we're asleep in it. That's really the bottom line, is we're not available to feel all of that moisture in our soul. And the more available you can refine yourself to be, the more full you'll be in that temple.
Do you find then that there's a, like it's a way of perceiving? So when you're with participants in your programs, there's a kind of almost like an invitation, your connection to love can make for participants. And it's also perhaps refining, you know, you talked before about how we can kind of perceive and reach, connect with our clients in a way to connect with the ways they might be conditioned or traumatized. Do you find that that's the case for you?
Yeah, I mean, I love that you're linking a quality of unconditional love with the capacity to see, because I think when we're busy making assessments or judgments or in a sort of evaluative mind, what we're most likely to see is either the participant's own doubts and sort of mirror them, or what to fix, you know, sort of a self-improvement project on their behalf. That's a very different perceptive field than the field that says, I can tolerate hearing, seeing, and feeling the impact your life has had on you. And I'm not in any way distracted by all the ways you protect yourself as a result of that hurt. So if you show up arrogant, or you show up cynical, or you show up walled off, or you show up flirty and friendly, like all of that's just, you know, a sort of an attempt by the psyche to make sure that no real contact happens. And it's our job as a practitioner to not respond to that in any way, not to get enrolled in that that dance of relationship, because they've had that all their lives. There's not going to be one thing alchemical about responding to people with the overt, obvious invitation they're making about how to circumscribe the connection. So you have to have the fortitude, clarity, and punch in a way to say, I'm going to talk to what's real. And the perception of what's real is both their original, unwounded, pre-verbal gifts they came into life to give. And what's equally real is whatever scars they're carrying from generations that they walk with and walk from, and all the events of their lives. Like I've done these programs, as you know, now for 19 years, and we always get trauma screenings from the participants before we start. And you read story after story. First of all, you just can't believe the human spirit and what people live through and manage to stay intact through. That's the first thing to say. But it really is a dirty, I don't mean, that's not even a good word. It's just a secret. Like, we don't talk about the enormity of the trauma people are walking with, but there's parents dying, there's alcoholism, there's parents' infidelity, there's forced migration, there's racism, there's colonialism, there's poverty, there's being sent to poverty boarding school too early, there's corporal punishment, there's accidents in war, there's people whose parents were in war and were so traumatized that they couldn't express love or express caring. There's children who had absent parents who were in another country because they were trying to make a better life for them. On and on and on. I mean, we could spend the whole podcast talking about the myriad ways hurt life shows up. So the first seeing is to be willing to see that, see the gravity of that, see the enormity of that, see the meaningfulness of that, and to be the person that they can tell their secrets to. And I think that's our first obligation. Can I be a safe harbor to hear you? And I think if one didn't in parallel believe that profound healing is possible, that transformation is inevitable, that life's natural development will resume the minute they're most stuck and most harmed places get opened up and well met, it would be sadistic to invite somebody to look. But I have seen over and over in miraculous ways, I think one would have to say miraculous ways, that when those facets of people's psyche are well met and invited in a safe way to unfold themselves, the repair process is profound, and the outcomes just are, you know, it's a revitalization, it's a re-inspiration, the whole hall of possibilities gets opened up again in that life. And for those people's children, of course, it's life-changing. So that's what I would say about seeing.
Mm. And I know we've spoken about your this capacity to meet or speak to the younger part of a client, maybe the origin of a particular type of the conditioning or trauma that's formed them. And I'm curious what that's like for you. I'm imagining it's a kind of way of perceiving that is less conceptual. It's not a method, but yeah, I wonder what that's like for you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the master of this art form for sure is Thomas, but I would say there's three stages of development as a practitioner. The first is being able as a sort of in your adult consciousness to have a conversation with them in their adult consciousness about the events of their lives. And that's how I think most coaches hold these conversations. And that's very important to do, because as I said, they're often safeguarding that information until they have the chance to have a conversation in which somebody is capable of holding the depth of what has happened. The second is probably less common, but I think a lot of us are doing, which is looking for a moment where you've created such a sense of empathy, kindness, fluency with each other, such a sense of trust that the psyche allows the younger regressive part to show up. And you see people's faces change, their eye contact changes, their voice changes. And all of a sudden you're having this extraordinarily profound conversation with the hurt part, with the youngest part. And it's very beautiful and it's very touching and it feels like time just stops in a way. And there's this opportunity to have that part feel held and cradled and connected in a way that they probably didn't feel. They probably felt quite alone and helpless earlier in their life. And the third dimension of it is, it's just, for me, a very new potential that I feel, which is to speak to that part, not in the moment of we're sitting in an office and it's arising in this 2024 talking to me, Amy, but to send that ping back to the moment of the inception of the hurt, like to really rewrite the book of life where it was first written, the ink was first dried. And that feels, it has a different, it's a different aperture. It has a different, you can feel something very holy is happening. And they can feel something very holy is happening. And time sort of, again, just stops and you're in an exchange, but the exchange has a depth and a, I don't have words actually. I'm not sure how to describe it.
Mm. Yeah. Well,
but that's really mystical healing, what we're talking about.
Yeah. And that's why I kind of got a sense before maybe the words become actually quite difficult because there's a energetic component to that type of healing and connection, which is dependent upon one's own integration and deep work and opening of centers in the body, centers of perception, things like that.
Yeah, that's right. And, there's an implicit question that I imagine listeners might have, like, how do I learn to do that? And all I can share is my own experience, which is really twofold. One is place yourself in contexts in which there are really high healers or great masters and apprentice yourself to them. And by no means am I counting myself in that category, but I've had the privilege to be with several, all of whom have been on your podcast, you know, Thomas and my teacher, Patrick Connor, and my teacher, Linda Cicera. And there are many more, Dustin DePerna, Shai Tubali. There's many beautiful people out there who are just a different level of consciousness. And to put yourself in the context of their work and watch them and take the transmission that happens from being in their presence and being part of the healing field that they can create and induct and hold over and over. And something starts to, you know, permeate your own capacity. It's a really beautiful kind of apprenticeship process. That's the first thing. And the second thing is to have work with a healer or healers or teachers who can initiate higher capacities energetically, as you said, Joel. These are intuitive arts. These are sort of mystical arts. They're healing arts. It's not like learning a good set of questions to ask a coachee or six ways to help coaching lead to high performance. These are esoteric skills for seeing more, for feeling more, in your ability to receive many, many more dimensions of information and an ability to pierce through current time as example. Those would be examples of that. And I think many, many people that do this kind of work are also cultivating skills for getting direct downloads, getting guidance, hearing intuitive information when they're working with a client. That's all part of the same assembly of an expanded tool set that's possible. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I'm thinking of that we were going to touch into developmental maturity here. And I wonder if you could say a few words about how you perceive that and how these capacities might be linked there or not. Maybe they're not part of that vector. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, first of all, just we should acknowledge our various wonderful colleagues who've spent decades helping us to understand what are the stages of adult development and vertical development. Jennifer Garvey Berger, Bob Anderson, Bob Keegan, Lisa Leahy, Susan Cook-Greider. I nod to all of them, and I'm grateful for the maps that they've given us, and Ken Wilber, of course. And I think they go as far as describing the very unusual state of being able to have cognitive fluidity and constantly grow and change your mind and learn new things and reinvent yourself regularly and to be able to host and engage a diversity of life experience and to be able to work emergently. And I think to the right of that is a set of skills that are not yet articulated very well, which is why I get a little tongue-tied trying to describe them, even though I have a felt sense of them, that are capacities, one might call them instrumentality, where it's no longer about my ego, my preferences, my path, my purpose. That's all sort of self-authoring. When I detach from what's life, what society has told me is expected of me, which is more socialized, and start to source guidance, direction, my choices from my own internal state, preference, you know, real North Star. And then I move to the place where I'm not so much ego driven and trying to figure out what matters to me or what will bring me meaning. I'm more interested in serving life and looking outward for where I can contribute. That's more self-transforming. I think there's another move that is more self-dissolved in a sense, where I really increasingly am operating from the unified field in harmony with what life needs of me, but the me is not the central actor anymore. And that process of being able to have healed enough of your own hurt and your own trauma and your own relational breaches and having met enough of your own emotional needs and spiritual needs to feel like you can really, you know, in a deep way, turn your life over to be not just guided, literally absorbed into something wider. I do think that's yet another stage of development. And, you know, and you see this in, for example, the great conflict mediators who've spent their whole life going into places of tremendous violence and trying to serve the source of peace as an instrument of peace. I think that's a good example. Or you think about people whose entire lives are dedicated to their devotion and their devout faith. That would be another example. It's not so rare what I'm talking about, but it is a higher state of consciousness that I think we can, as practitioners, tap into in meaningful ways, even short of, you know, a full awakening. I think we can cultivate some of these more refined gifts of being transparent enough to get field intelligence, to tap into the implicate order, to be an agent of timeless healing.
Hmm. Yeah, that's something you said there I've been thinking about a bit, which is the ability to tap into it as well. Because on one sense, it could feel like, I mean, this is true, I think, that there's a way that can become like a stage or something that we reliably locate ourselves in. And but that also, you know, but maybe there's also a way that we can access those as states as well. For example, you know, I notice as a coach, there's just this mode of coaching that I enter into, and it's a potent field of transformation. And then I can go out and be, you know, with my family, and there's a different mode of being there. Maybe even I get into a, you know, contraction around something with my stepson, you know. So and I think that's quite interesting, because it I've seen people in groups as well, like you do group work, where people collectively start to access something quite phenomenal together. Mm. And it's like, whoa, like, so there's something about that collective capacity too.
Yeah. I mean, I think in the way that you're describing it, it makes it wonderfully more accessible, right? All of us have absolutely had moments where we were so present and so in the moment and so engaged and enthralled with the alive dialogue with a client that we really do disappear in that sense. We're just a field of response that is sourcing from somewhere wider than ourselves, than our own sort of mental response or even emotional response or even intuitive response. So I love that. And I think in that sense, probably everyone listening has had some taste of what we're pointing to as practitioners. I think that's much more common than we think and probably more common than we give language to. So I agree with that. And of course, all of us, you know, it's a long, long walk. The path of what I'm pointing to is like lifetimes of development. So if we even have a few precious moments where we feel we're in that purity of expression of life, I think that's gorgeous. And of course, that's, you know, 2 hours later, you could be in a very conflictual conversation and not demonstrating equally levels of poise and receptivity and openness. I oscillate all day long between moments of, you know, where I feel like I'm bringing the best of who I am to a conversation or to a moment, and times where I'm much more in my more regressed, reactive mode. And I think the journey of cultivating these more celestial skills, ironically, is a journey downward into the muck of your own subconscious scars and your own contractions, because as those get excavated, it's like there's literally more room in your system for these higher capacities to come online. And while your hard drive of your being is occupied by pain and fear and self punishment, it's very hard. It's they're like mutually exclusive in a sense. So it's like, as you lower the level of fear, you lower the level of self negation, you lower the level of isolation and loneliness, you lower the level of hurt and grief in your field, that opens up the potential of possibility of more beauty, more inspiration, more nourishment coming in. And in that field of greater fullness, you're more accessible and available for something else. And I think we've misunderstood the development of practitioners as being primarily a skill cultivation as opposed to primarily a restorative process.
Mm. Yeah, that's a beautiful framing of that, actually. And so therefore, yeah, this restorative process being really important, the ability to do that integration work. This question pops in and I'm curious about it. You mentioned earlier in our conversation about essence. And I wonder where that plays a role here. You know, sometimes it's like there can be a focus on the trauma integration, but sometimes there's like the sense of essence of a person coming through. And I wonder what you mean by that and what the importance of focusing on that is. Are we talking about like almost like a unique expression of the divine through them, or are we talking more a universal essence? Yeah.
I've learned much of this from Patrick Connor. You know, I believe, as I understand it, we are talking about a unique, you know, sun ray in the light of the divine, a unique footprint that we bring into life. And so many of us lose sight of that because of the life events that happen early in our development that sort of separate us from what would otherwise be a sort of free-flowing expression of that soul essence. And when you can help somebody to reconnect to it, it unleashes all the natural extraordinariness they carry inside dormantly anyway. Somebody doesn't have to go figure out how to be the most exquisite version of themselves. That's their birthright. That's who they are. You just have to help them to remove all the sort of spider webs that are in the way of it. So, you know, it could be as simple as I have had people in programs say, last night I spontaneously wrote a poem for the first time in 20 years. I read that as, oh, my soul essence came back online. Or I called my father and we made amends after not speaking for a decade. And I told him how I loved him. That expression of pure unfiltered, unprotected love, that's also soul essence. Or somebody says, you know, I suddenly see what I'm meant to do for the world, and I understand what my life is really guiding me towards and what the whole journey has been in the service of. That's an expression of soul essence. It's that is not so esoteric in a way. It's really how we're meant to participate in the fabric of life. That is the hero's journey. That is the essential reason that a soul takes up an incarnational expression. And I don't think there's anything more important that we can do as practitioners than helping reignite a close connection between a person and their soul in that way. Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe like also that following of passion, you know, maybe we get back to love again, but there's like this passion and curiosity for life and for particular things in life.
Yeah, and one of the things I talk about a lot in leadership work is how we've built organizations that are antithetical to the expression of passion. We've told ourselves that we're not supposed to be personal in the workplace. Workplaces put a primary emphasis on autonomy and resilience instead of interdependence and interpenetration and belonging. We are not supposed to have, you know, emotional needs in the workplace. We're disembodied in the workplace. It's a very industrial psychological model of a living human system. But as you help turn on the various lights in the room of possibility for, let's use your word, real passion to come back into the river of life. You get creativity, you get innovation, you get audacity, you get joy, you get play, you get connection, you get inclusion, you get psychological safety, you get everything organizations are now saying they want. But you really got to change the guidelines of how we're allowed to be with each other in order to create a community of aliveness, if that's what you aspire to. Yeah.
Yeah, that actually brings up something I was just thinking about, which is the vision of or how organizations might be being invited to change, and how you see that communities of aliveness and, you know, the reconnections, moving away from independence. Do you see? I mean, I imagine that's why a lot of organizations reach out to you, that maybe it's not explicitly articulated in that way. But do you see that there's a hunger for this? And I also think about, and maybe I'll speak more about the vision for what's needed, what's coming into our world, and whether, you know, like, let me stop there. Let me ask those questions first, and I'll sharpen my other question because.
Well, I want to hearken back to something you said earlier that we left aside, Joel, which is it true that groups of executives can create a field of coherence in which more direct knowledge comes in, or more non-local intelligence gets activated, or they start to co-create in ways that are much more disruptive, much more inventive, much more outrageous? My experience is very definitely yes. And what I find even more beautiful is that at a certain level of coherence, when everybody kind of lands in their body, when everybody has sort of done a significant piece of inner healing, and everybody has started to share their stories, the wisdom no longer has to come from the facilitators. People start saying things that are so touching and so profound and so fresh, that all you have to do is harvest the natural arising intelligence coming from the group. And I believe that there will soon not be any possibility in the world of AI for an organization to be a front runner past just relying on what AI can do for everyone, unless they learn how to create teams and teaming that produces that kind of electric fertility. And I believe that the only way to get that kind of bubbly, porous, nimble fluidity in a group is to heal together. I just, that is the only, well, certainly the only way I've ever seen it happen, because otherwise our people are just operating behind a shield. And even if they're going through trust exercises or they're having well-facilitated conversations, the youngest parts of them are still feeling not welcome and feeling unsafe and feeling protected as a fundamental state. You know, people often talk about the state of fear and the state of love. It's really true. You can't be in both in parallel, although of course there are gradations of each. But fundamentally, if a team wants to work together in that radically alive way, they have to journey home together.
Yeah, that's really powerful. It's funny you bring AI in, and it kind of connects to my question that I didn't bring in, but how something like this might proliferate. And in a sense, I was going to bring in time, you know, like, and I know that's, it's like, is there, do we have time for everybody to go through their healing, for us to navigate these times, which I know isn't the right way to frame it, because it's kind of putting a particularly linear cause and effect. Mm-hmm. It's more like there's a blossoming of this way of, and this, the need for this, the orientation to this, as you know, something's breaking down, like an industrial model, and then with AI coming in, which could really double down on that kind of industrial
mechanistic way of doing things.
So it seems like they're kind of co-arising together. And
yeah,
what's your sense of like the AI and how you're relating to that? Yeah,
I mean, I'm in no way an AI expert or even particularly AI engaged, but I do feel that in the rising of AI, in parallel to the vociferation of polarization and hatred, the urgency of doing things that are deeply humanizing in the workplace and deeply love-based in society. So I put my attention as just one practitioner on refining those capacities. And I don't ask myself the question, do we have time? I more rest in, I can't make a different choice. I don't know another choice. And because I've seen exponential healing happen under the right conditions, I don't have a bias to assuming it takes a lot of time. I also don't have an orientation to thinking you can do a lifetime of healing work in a weekend workshop. It's sort of paradoxical. Like, I know that the path is long and the unwinding is layer on layer on layer, because that's how it's been for me. And I've had extraordinary help. But I also know that there are catalytic potentials that if we seize them and we nourish them and we prioritize them and then we practice, it's a daily practice, that many, many things can heal and melt. Many things can change, and profoundly so. Profoundly so. So I take a lot of hope from that.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful. And me too, from, I imagine there's a growing number of people reaching out, you know, in thirsty and need for this type of work. Yeah.
Yeah, there's been also, I think, you know, in no small part, Joel, through the visionary work of Coaches Rising, I think much more dialogue between practitioners of coaching and facilitation and team intervention and the world of personal development, spiritual development, psychological healing. And that marriage, I think, has the potential to rewire the way business thinks about vertical development, executive development, team dynamics, organizational health, in a way that will hopefully come in time and be lightning through the you know, stuck energy.
Yeah, and as we kind of move to the end of our towards the end of our conversation, something I've been thinking
about. It's so wild because it goes so fast. It's so sweet to be with you.
Yeah, but totally. Yeah. It's great. It's a good, you know, doing these podcasts is a good excuse for me to just hang out with you.
Wonderful
conversation.
For me too.
Yeah, just thinking about beyond coaching, you know, that's something we've been talking about a little bit, which is the word coach, which is also useful because now it's starting to become known more generally in the public. So people now, you know, 15 years ago, people didn't really know what you meant by that. Maybe a bit longer, but now people get it. And it's become so saturated, it's become so well used, that word, that it's also losing its meaning a little bit. And it doesn't afford for me the sense of maybe the territories you're talking about, where, you know, there's deep healing taking place. And that boundary between therapy and coaching, which I know we want to respect that. We have to really respect our capacities, that should I say. At the same time, I feel like there's a kind of an avatar of a coach healer space holder that's needed in our times. And I clearly hear that articulated in your work.
Yeah, I mean, I think the days when we think, you know, coaches' jobs are to look forward into people's potential and a therapist's job is to look backward at their childhood, that's over. You know, that split is just so artificial and so disrespectful to the depth of work that coaches are doing everywhere in the world. I don't think that's true. I do think the caution that you and I both are committed to of people only making moves within their client work that is within the scope of practice and of their expertise, and knowing where that line is, and then systematically moving that line if they're called to this kind of work. There's many, many ways to become more trauma literate, more trauma versatile, and more trauma capable if that's what the work somebody's called to do. I also feel like acknowledging and honoring our mutual friend, Nicholas Johnny, for his very visionary book, Leader as Healer, because I think we have to move the notion of the healing coming from us as practitioners to the expectation that any leader of transformation in any organization has to start to have some of these capabilities. They have to be able to hold space. They have to be able to cradle and welcome the people who work for them when they're hurting or when they're in tragedy or when they're in, you know, a sudden emergent world crisis. They have to be able to be attuned to the and sensitive to the emotional field around them, many things. So I think we need to start talking about these as competencies for executives, not competencies for practitioners. And if that premise is correct, that means that we as practitioners have to even get more refined in order to be the front edge of their development. And I find that very thrilling. You know, I just think we're going to get more and more able to put the acupuncture needle where it needs to go at an individual level, at a team level, at a systemic level, at a society level, and to do it with finesse and refinement and precision and love. And as that happens, you know, the meridians open up, the water flows.
Yeah. I think that's a beautiful place to bring our conversation to a close. I know you'll be teaching the first module of Reimagine Leadership as well. So depends when you're listening to this podcast, but that's coming up later this year.
I'm so looking forward to having the time with everybody. Yeah, I hope you'll join us in the fall.
Yeah, nice. Thanks so much, Amy.
Thank you, Joel. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training, The Neuroscience of Change. This program reveals the biology of change, showing us what happens in the brain and the body when different coaching techniques are used. You'll learn how to work with the innate pathways of change in all of us, so you can create powerful transformation with your clients. Just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by February the 7th. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well. And I'll see you again next time.